This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As part of Black History Month in McLean County, find out about a late 1800s brain drain of minority residents.
By denying African Americans a ticket to the middle class, what this community did was force a lot of educated African American children to seek employment elsewhere.
Museum of History archivist and librarian Bill Kemp also introduces you to omnibus driver Absalom Hawkins. Plus, Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner drops by. Ryan Denham tells you about a rural shortage, and it's not internet connections or doctors, it's attorneys. And you will hear a folk, blues, rock mix of music from Taylor Steele and the Lovebreakers. All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington residents will see more investment in roadwork next year, plus the first steps toward a new pool at O'Neill Park on the west side. Those are just a few of the highlights in the city's new $230 million spending plan. City Council members got another look at it last night with a final vote scheduled for April. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with Ryan Denham to talk about what the new budget means for taxpayers.
The mayors of Bloomington-Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Once again, thanks, Ryan. Appreciate it.
So you got another look at next year's budget at the meeting last night. This is the big $230 million spending plan that goes into effect May 1st. So what do you think are some of the most important things that this budget reflects?
I think the first thing, of course, is obviously, as usual, it's balanced. And we not only balance our budgets, but we always turn money back. So we put money into our reserves at the end of every year. We don't spend it just because it's been allocated. The budget's only going – the total amount is only going up a little over 1%. Some of our expenses have gone up beyond that, but we've been able to make do with respect to improving economies and actually a little more proper and sophisticated budgeting to really get a more accurate picture of what we're going to need and when we're going to need it. So I think those are important, but definitely we're moving forward on capital projects. Our operating side is generally pretty good. We've got a statewide award for our police fire pension funding, and that's in pretty good shape. We do have some challenges in about 2024 that we'll have to deal with, but those things are in good shape. It's our capital projects that we're focusing on, and that is the O'Neill Pool or Aquatic Center. How much do we put in there? I'm strongly in favor of making it an aquatic center and more of a destination for people, not just throughout Bloomington, but potentially, since it's by an interstate, throughout the region. Also, the expansion of the library that's been long discussed. I'm hoping that we can finally make some progress and move on that. And a new fire station of some form, and that could take a variety of different forms, in the northeast part of Bloomington to try to reduce our emergency 911 response times. They are not bad there, but they're not great. And we want to make sure that 90% or more of our calls are answered within 6 minutes. So those are from my takeaway, the highlights. And there are a lot of very good things in the budget. I think Tim Gleason did an excellent job in balancing our needs and some of what myself and the council would like to see in the new budget.
There is a public hearing. As you talk about next steps, there's a public hearing on the budget. It's coming
up. That would
be March
9th.
Yeah. Council would then be voting sometime in April. So what decisions still have to be made on the budget? I guess what is still in flux at this point over the next month and a half or so?
Well, some of that will depend on what the council decides. From my perspective, there are things that I would like to have added to the budget, but I'm not going to bring them up now because this is kind of the 11th hour, because this has been going on for quite some time. From the standpoint of the staff, I think the public is only now, with the second meeting, talking about this, being engaged in this. So it doesn't mean that we won't make some adjustments, but dramatic adjustments are very unlikely at this point.
So the next budget is looking to set aside $1.3 million for repairs to the 46-year-old Market Street parking garage in downtown Bloomington, which is a fair amount of money. What do you think
Yes.
the long-term plan should be for that garage?
I think we need to recognize that with the 380, or I believe it is something like that, nearly 400 spaces every day that are in the lot, it's an important, or garage, excuse me, it's not a lot, is that we should revitalize that, maybe even as Alderman Black mentioned last night, tear it down, start from scratch. Now, we would be really having lots of parking issues if we just tore the whole thing down and maybe didn't do it in phases. So I think that should be done. And we might, therefore, in a reconfiguration of this building, make it more of a destination and maybe even rent out some more of the floor rather than just to the post office. So maybe have some light retail come in as well. So that's the approach that I think we should take, rather than continuing to Band-Aid the garage with, you know, million-some-dollar fixes here, $500,000 fixes here. It was built in the 1970s, early 70s. I think it's about time for us to have something that's more modern.
I guess, why hasn't it been dealt with in a more permanent manner already? I mean, the idea of it aging and requiring a few $100,000
here and there. Well, because Bloomington, for the better part of the last two generations, has been focused more on sprawl and has let lots of things, including our streets and infrastructure, deteriorate. And those are what I would call legacy costs. There's nothing that you can do to complain about the past. You just got to go forward. I mean, we've got lots of sewers and sidewalks and street repaving that should have been done in the past. They were not. Those were not high priorities. The parking garage was not a high priority. I think that should have been a critical piece of downtown revitalization at least 20 years ago. But that's my opinion. I wasn't mayor then. I'm mayor now. And that's what we're going to try to do.
What's a new garage cost these days?
Oh, it depends on what you include in that.
Well, let's say light retail, you know, nothing too elaborate.
It's very likely in the $14, $15 million range. It could be more, but we would only escalate the cost if we had other tenants that were going to guarantee that they were going to come in. So certainly for $15 million, we could roughly, give or take, you know, replace what we have, maybe make some room for small additional retail and the current post office that has a contract with the city as it is, and have more amenities and have more safety features within the garage. I think it would be a much more attractive place for people to park, kind of like some of the garages in Uptown Normal, than it currently is.
So the new budget, as proposed, has some money for design work for the O'Neill Park Pool project.
That's correct. $738,000.
To be precise. What about the new this idea of a new East Side Fire Station, library expansion? Is there any money set aside for either of those?
Well, some of the library board itself has been pushing that and paying for those costs largely in terms of planning and what some of their options there might be. We're a little behind that point in deciding on a fire station or fire stations. There are many options that we have in terms of kind of moving the fire station chess pieces around in the Northeast, and that's some of what we're still exploring. Now, the good news of that is that you don't need as much time to design a fire station and to move forward as you would with a library, and trying to turn the library and perhaps much of City Hall into more of a campus and destination than it currently is.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham, here with Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. So Terry, in the new budget, tax revenue is in pretty decent shape. It's up about 1.5% across various taxes that the city pulls in. There's one area of weakness, though: utility tax. So
yes.
This is the city is budgeting for almost $500,000 less in utility tax next year, largely because of the reduction in the telecommunication side of that. And I guess, so in plain English, that's because people are, you know, with cell phones are moving away from landlines, and so
Absolutely.
They're not paying that tax. So losing nearly $500,000, how do you account for that? Because some of that historically has been earmarked for police and fire pensions.
Well, they are. The increase that was passed in 2014, and by increase, we're still lower than the town of Normal in terms of our utility taxes. But that's going to create even more difficulties in 2024 when we don't have as much money in our police fire pension funding. Now, the state's trying to work on some of that, but and that may help us at the margins, but we're still anticipating having to make some real tough decisions as we move forward with police and fire pensions. Not as many as we already have. So I think our biggest hump was back in 2014 when we dedicated a variety of revenues to our police fire funding.
What do you mean by tough decisions in 2024?
That means we have to figure out, do we raise fees or taxes, or do we make some additional cuts in order to try to fund the police fire pension obligations?
Why is 2024 sort of the magic, not magic number, but why is that the decision?
Just in terms of the, in terms of our investments, the investments have not been quite as robust as we've heard. I believe we projected, this is not exactly right, but somewhere around 7.5% returns, and I think they've come closer to about 1% less than that. And so we, that, as I understand it, is it, you know, is the year where we may have a significant gap, and we got to figure out how to fill it.
I want to ask about a couple of kind of bigger picture economic things. The last recession that we had, the quote-unquote Great Recession, ended about 11 years ago now, and there are some economists who argue that we are due for another smaller contraction in the next year or two. So how well-positioned do you think the city is for something like that? Like, in your mind, as you're making decisions today, are you accounting for the possibility of another recession, how that would cut into
retail,
income tax?
I mean, we were trying to be as little C conservative as possible, and that is cautious, I would say, in terms of making budgetary projections. It doesn't mean that you're not going to make mistakes from time to time, but we're definitely trying to be as cautious as we can, and in terms of building up our reserves, or what some people might call your savings or rainy day fund. And we did have about 10 years ago a situation where the city was a week away from not being able to make payroll, because they didn't have any reserves. Those days are long gone. We've got our fiscal house in order, but that doesn't mean that fiscal house can't be shaken by an economic earthquake. And so obviously those are the kinds of things we don't know, but we're trying to be as cautious as possible. We're not trying to go out on a limb and assume that whatever revenues and growth we have now are just going to continue. That growth in revenue roughly covers the costs of our increasing expenditures, about 1.5%. So that's why there are no tax fee increases of any form in this budget. And actually, most of our budgets have been that way. It's just the three that had some sort of tax or fee increases are the ones that some people remember and get upset about. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter who you are as mayor. You can't save people from this thing called inflation. And it's not like we're doing something dramatic that we haven't done in the past that costs significant amounts of money, or that we've got more employees. Quite the contrary. We have about 800, we had about 850 employees, full-time equivalents, 10 years ago. We have 650 now, and we serve about 5,000 more people. So we are doing more with less.
One interesting area where the city has found some savings, it was, you know, this budget year, and you'll see it reflected next year, is by bringing in the lawyers who represent the city. So previously it was handled by an outside firm. You'd pay them as like contracted attorneys. They have since been moved to city staff, which is projected to save the city, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars.
Quarter of a million dollars.
Are there any downsides to bringing lawyers in-house like that? What are the barriers to doing that? Why did it take till now?
Well, that's actually a really excellent question, Ryan. And those are mostly personnel political kinds of decisions. The previous city manager, frankly, loved to contract out things and to hire consultants and whatever for different things. And there were some advantages to contracting out our legal services, but they were much more expensive than the previous city manager had anticipated. He argued it was going to save us money. Well, it did not. And some of it's because more people were suing us for all kinds of things, usually frivolous things. And you know, it's not like the city's lost a major lawsuit in a decade or so. So there are a variety of factors, but it's mainly that the about half the city council backed the previous city manager, and they kept us on a contract basis. And it's not just Sorling Northrop, the firm out of Springfield that we contracted with, but we had external consultants to handle our union negotiations. And this is where our current city manager has more than saved us his entire salary in any given set of negotiations, because he does the negotiating himself. And the people from the unions, you know, they may not always like what they hear, but they know he's a straight shooter and he's being honest with them, and that they can ask him questions. I talked to one representative last night, said, gosh, it's such a breath of fresh air to actually be able to talk to a city manager and get an answer. And you will get an answer. You may not always like it, but you'll get an answer, and it'll be a truthful one from Tim Gleason.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner talking with Ryan Denham. The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Coos.
Support for WGLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA, SIPC. More than 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman is a proud sponsor of WGLT since 1983. This is WGLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a shortage of rural lawyers. No lawyer jokes, please. Ryan Dunham has that report in just a few more minutes. Introducing a man who drove vice presidents and governors, wealthy landowners, and visiting artists all about Bloomington Normal more than a century ago. During Black History Month, this episode of McHistory shows you the working life of a well-known African-American man in the Twin Cities and tells you about a 19th century brain drain.
Absalom Hawkins, probably one of the best-known colored men ever a resident of Bloomington, is dead.
Absalom Hawkins was born in 1855, we believe. Now, his obituary says he was born in Kansas City, Kansas, but research done by the McLean County Museum of History indicates he was likely born in Tennessee. He was the son of formerly enslaved parents. He comes to Bloomington in the 1870s, if not a little bit earlier, with his mother, Rachel Hawkins, from Kansas City. This is Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History.
Hello, I'm Vincent Carta for the McLean County Museum of History.
He was a driver for most of his adult life, driving a hack or a larger omnibus. So think of city buses or taxi cabs, but those pulled by horses.
Mr. Hawkins' career was a remarkable and interesting one, and in his long residence in Bloomington, he had many ups and downs. But above it all, he bore the same cheerful, hopeful spirit and always looked on the bright side of things.
Absalom was based primarily out of the Ashley House, which was at the northwest corner of the Courthouse Square. In the latter half of the 19th century, probably the finest hotel in downtown Bloomington, and the Illinois House stands at that lot today.
Some people whom he has driven, who have been widely reputed for their knowledge and high standing, were dissected by him as, quote, dubbed cheap guys, and various epithets by which he would designate their lack of generosity or penuriousness. Nothing so condemned a man in his estimation as these failings.
In the 19th and into the first half of the 20th century, in the Twin Cities, African Americans were relegated to lower working class positions. They were house servants, they were washerwomen, they were cooks, they were barbers.
Was an employee of Foster and McBean when those gentlemen ran the omnibus line, and he further bore the proud reputation of being the only colored cabman in the city, a fact of which he was cognizant better than anyone else.
By denying African Americans a ticket to the middle class in the Twin Cities, what this community did was force a lot of educated African-American children that could attend, say, Illinois State Normal University to seek employment elsewhere. So we had a brain drain of African-Americans, educated African-Americans that could have given so much to this community.
In manner, he was as chivalrous as any knight of the medieval times, and it was his great boast in his palmy days that he knew and had a speaking acquaintance with more ladies than any man in Bloomington, and this was a truism not to be denied.
Omnibuses were like buses, but pulled by horses, and running a standard route. So from the Windsor Hotel to the train station either on the west side of Bloomington Union Station, the Chicago and Alton Railroad Station, or on the near east side where Beer Nuts is today, where the Illinois Central Passenger Station was.
At heart, he was courageous, polite to the extreme, and honest in his dealings.
Even though Absalom was an African-American, he had access to at least a window into wealthier white men of power and had some acquaintance with them.
Characters such as he was are few, and the refreshing originality of the man has made him a place in local history.
He was considered a dandy for his day, well-dressed gentleman. He always wore a fine silk hat, a clean white vest, and a tall tie. And in his buttonhole, he would rarely fail to have a flower.
The memory of Absalom Hawkins will live down the ages.
Sometime around 1893, though, he hit a pothole. The streets of Bloomington were notorious at the time. He was thrown from his vehicle and knocked unconscious. He suffered a kind of a debilitating injury after that accident. He will die on September 24th, 1903. He will only be 47 years old at the time of his death.
Absalom Hawkins, The Daily Bulletin, September 25th, 1903.
McHistory is a co-production of WGLT and the McLean County Museum of History, using the words of those who've come before to remember the way we used to be and sometimes how things still are. If you like local histories like this one, you can subscribe to our McHistory podcast at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care. Heritage has been offering specialized healthcare services to seniors in Bloomington Normal for more than 50 years. On the web at heritageofcare.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new wrinkle in PE class, which isn't so much about the body, it's about the mind. It's hard for rural communities in Illinois to attract or keep the doctors, teachers, or even grocery stores, which together make everyday life possible in a small town. Now, another professional shortage has emerged in rural Illinois. There are not enough attorneys, and the problem is getting worse. Ryan Denham has the story.
The Chicagoland area is home to two-thirds of Illinois' population, but 90% of its lawyers. It leaves the rest of us, the other 95 counties, with the remaining 10%. The Illinois Supreme Court Commission on Professionalism says there are 39 counties in Illinois that haven't added a new attorney in the last 4 years.
Is the small-town lawyer still going to exist, you know, 10 to 15 years from now or 20 years from now?
That's Amelia Burgess, a partner with Boland Robinson & Ellis, who's based in Bloomington.
We don't have the answer to that, but we do see a need, and we as a firm have a desire to meet that need.
Last month, Burgess's firm opened a branch office in Lincoln, where there's a shortage of lawyers. Only two new attorneys have begun practicing there in the past 4 years. The problem is most acute in the family law area.
Just from a, you know, very real human perspective, that's concerning, because when you're dealing with a family law case, those are very serious issues that impact your life. They impact the life of your family. And the idea of people trying to navigate that system on their own, when they would benefit from help, we really saw the potential need there to do good in the community.
Logan County has just over 30,000 residents, but less than 25 lawyers. Located just southwest of Bloomington Normal, Lincoln is the Logan County seat. The historic downtown courthouse remains the center of town. Less than 2 months after opening, demand was so high in the Lincoln area that Burgess's BRE law firm added regular office hours starting this week to meet with potential clients. Thomas Harris has seen the shortage in Lincoln, too. He was on the front lines as a judge based in Lincoln from 2007 to 2013. That's when he became an appellate court justice. With few options, Harris saw more and more people representing themselves in his courtroom. The legal term for that is pro se. Nationally, 3 out of 5 people in civil cases go to court without a lawyer.
It was such a luxury, almost, to have lawyers presenting the case, because this isn't easy. And I think that's one thing that folks are most shocked at when they get into court. I think they think that there's going to be a lot of assistance provided by the judge, and the judge is not allowed to provide that kind of assistance.
Harris says that's especially true for child custody cases.
Those are very difficult cases. They are very fact-intensive that require that the parties be able to present evidence. There are legal rules, rules of procedure, and evidentiary rules that they're required to comply with. And without a lawyer, these folks really can be at a loss as to how to proceed.
Harris says that puts a judge in a terrible bind.
Because the judge has to make this very critical determination, potentially without all of the facts he or she needs in order to make it.
Harris serves on the Illinois Supreme Court Commission on Access to Justice, which is trying to make it easier for people to represent themselves. He has a few theories as to why rural lawyers are disappearing. He says clients have grown accustomed to the internet's self-help model of Googling everything. He says that's devalued the legal profession by making lawyers seem like a luxury.
I think it really is hard for people to come up with the necessary funds to hire a lawyer for some of these cases.
For young lawyers graduating from one of Illinois' 9 law schools, their own student loan debt, often in the 6 figures, is a major consideration. That's according to Mark Palmer, a Champaign-Urbana native who's chief counsel for the Illinois Supreme Court Commission on Professionalism. His recent research on the disappearing rural lawyer has been well-read in Illinois legal circles. Palmer says, like everyone else, law school graduates are flocking toward urban areas.
That's a huge cloud hovering over their head, and they immediately have to think of my well-being, my ability to not only pay those student debt back, but earn a reasonable living and find a supply and demand that can meet my needs as any individual entering the occupation. I think they're seeing the solutions to that, those questions come from much more urban areas.
But that doesn't mean they're always right. Rural lawyers argue that if you do it right, you can make a very comfortable living in small or medium-sized communities. That's what Maggie Clark is doing. After working in Bloomington right after law school, she recently chose to set up her own practice back in her hometown of Pontiac. She opened the doors January 1st.
When you're born and raised in a town of 10,000 people, you tend to want to be in that kind of small community. And so I'm just very happy to be back here in Pontiac.
Before going out on her own, Clark asked around the Livingston County legal community and found that its current 45 or so lawyers were swamped. When people couldn't find an attorney in town, they'd hire one from Bloomington Normal, which means they have to pay for that lawyer to travel to Pontiac. Clark did the math and saw there would be enough business for her. But that math also reveals another challenge of working in a small town, conflicts of interest.
If I'm an attorney and I've represented someone on a case, you know, and later down the road, they're getting divorced and I represented the other party, you know, I have to send them somewhere else. And when you have a very limited number of law firms to pick from, you know, you run into those issues.
And Clark says it's not just the number of attorneys that's the problem.
You go to these smaller communities and you look around and your lawyers are older. There's not a lot of young faces. And I also think you find there's not a lot of women in these smaller rural communities. And I think there are some cases where, you know, your client is going to say, I want a woman to represent me. I want, you know, someone who understands what I'm going through to kind of be the one to guide me through that process.
A shortage of attorneys also means it's harder to find one who can take on a pro bono case, or one for free. Ford County has a population of 13,000 people. It only has around 12 attorneys, and only about 4 or 5 of them don't work on the bench or in the state's attorney's office. Here's Mike McElvain, a Bloomington attorney who serves in the Public Interest Law Initiative's 11th Judicial Circuit Pro Bono Committee.
Local circuit is mainly Bloomington. It's worked well there. But the outlying counties were having a difficult time finding attorneys with time and expertise to handle their pro bono needs in those counties.
There are efforts underway to chip away at the problem, or at least treat its symptoms. The Illinois Supreme Court Commission on Access to Justice is working to develop legal forms that are written in plain English, not legalese, so that self-represented litigants can better understand them. The commission also supports the continued and expanded use of court-based navigators like Justice Corps, which already has a McLean County presence. Here's Justice Harris.
But it doesn't really have the ability to help in what I think is the most important area, which is enhancing the availability of lawyers for folks, because I think ultimately, in order to have true access to justice, folks need to have legal representation in many of these cases.
Other states are facing similar issues. A working group for the New Mexico Supreme Court recently recommended more aggressive recruiting out of state and loan forgiveness for lawyers providing services in rural or underserved areas. A partial solution in Illinois that's already allowed is called limited scope representation. A lawyer agrees to help with part of a legal case, not all of it, usually for a reduced fee. The a la carte lawyer may just prepare some paperwork for you or appears in court for only the real difficult parts of the case. Here's Mike McElvain.
It's completely contrary to our training, though. I mean, our mothers taught us to clean everything up on our plate. And for my 47 years, I've been taught that when I take on something, I finish it. So it's a little awkward doing a piece of the whole claim and then stepping away from it. But hopefully we'll all learn to accept that.
Mark Palmer with the Supreme Court Commission on Professionalism says there's also been a rise nationally in subscription services for legal consultations. Rocket Lawyer offers premium membership for $39 a month. Legal Shield starts at $25 a month.
That's where the lawyers and the legal profession need to step up and start seeing what are some solutions so everybody, regardless of your geographic location, can get reasonable and cost-effective access to justice.
Palmer says if the traditional law firm product is no longer marketable by default in some areas, it's time to reevaluate the business model, deliver a new product that's affordable and in demand. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find links to Mark Palmer's research on the disappearing rural attorney at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, the spicy folk, blues, rock, and country music of Taylor Steele. Physical education is not just running the mile and doing push-ups anymore. Technology is crafting the next generation of gym class while teachers focus more on mental health than getting fit. Peter Medlin reports.
When you think of PE class, what's the vision in your head? Are you climbing a rope? Is it hoping not to get picked last in dodgeball? Maybe it makes you think of a gym class scene in a movie.
Physical education in this school is a disgrace. I mean, standing in line for 40 minutes is hardly aerobically effective. I doubt I've worked off the calories in a stick of carefree gum.
That's what physical education felt like for a lot of people.
There was definitely a rope that had to be climbed.
That's Mike Graham. He's taught for over 20 years. He's at Williamsburg Elementary in Geneva now. Last year, he was named the Illinois Elementary PE Teacher of the Year. And he says PE has evolved quite a bit since he started. For one, physical fitness isn't the goal, especially at his K-5 grade levels.
You're not going to make these, you know, fitness freaks out of these kids by my two-day-a-week program.
He believes physical education in 2020 strives to be about health, both physical and social-emotional. That's why in Graham's gym, there's a giant poster hung on the wall that says,
I see you, I care about you, I want you to succeed.
He got the sign idea from Twitter. He's been active on social media for years, building a network of other teachers. In many schools, like Graham's, he's the only PE teacher, so it's easy to fall into a routine.
Getting them to shift the whole paradigm and flip it upside down and say, like this is another classroom. My gym is the biggest classroom in the school, and we're here, we're learning things. And if the kids leave and don't know why, then I'm just a glorified, activity director.
Graham has a website where he curates his class and keeps parents up to date. He also has a YouTube channel sharing his lessons. Over in Sycamore, Shelley Tranchita teaches high school PE. She also has a YouTube channel where she and her club of Cheetah Girls, a nod to her last name, make health and fitness videos.
They're going to be doing 5 1-minute workouts. And
their health and wellness club produces a podcast, too.
Well, I'm excited to have our first podcast here talking about mental health, suicide awareness.
May I have your attention,
we
please?
Are in a school, GSA, so we're going to hear things like that.
Tranchita and a student have health-related conversations with other students and teachers. And she says it's time to stop seeing physical education as limited to physical.
I think just as the research comes through and as we learn more, the physical is the mental and the mental is the physical, and they hold hands and they're tied together.
Her mind and body fitness class is an exercise in that concept. Sometimes it's an up-tempo workout. Sometimes they venture into breathing and meditation.
I do some chanting meditations, which the first time we do it, everyone looks at me like I have, you know, 5 heads. But then the feedback that I get from that is, oh my gosh, let's do it again. I felt amazing afterwards.
Back in 2017, Illinois rescinded its daily PE requirement. Several bills since have pushed for a mandatory minutes minimum that aligns with national standards, but it's failed to find legislative footing. Shape America sets those standards for teaching PE. Michelle Carter is a senior program manager. She says there are still some states where you can teach PE without a specific content area credential or certification.
It definitely is one of the factors that play into why physical education might not be considered an academic subject or that it's not as essential as the other subjects.
It's also undeniable that PE can be a uniquely vulnerable space in a school. Bullying can wreck a student's interest in PE and stop them from building the healthy habits teachers aim for. Advocates also rail against widespread PE exemptions for kids involved with sports or other extracurriculars. Rob Bisegli is the CEO of Action for Healthy Kids. They're a Chicago-based nonprofit providing grants and supporting schools and parents implementing health programs.
I think really saying to ourselves, okay, I can't remove all these different stressors in their lives, but I can help them build the capacity to deal with them when they come down the pike. And I think that's really important.
And both Bisegli and the others agree PE teachers are in a prime position to help as students try to develop healthy kids on the inside and out. I'm Peter Medlin.
You're listening to 89.1 FM and WGLT.org and Sound Ideas. Hello, I'm Charlie Schlenker. In 2020, you're the boss at the ballot box. Now, this year, many college students are joining the electoral process as the 2020 elections approach. Chase Kavanaugh has more on how a Northern Illinois community college both registers and educates new voters.
Kishwaukee College in Malta has many students who have or will reach voting age, but education instructor Cynthia DeSef says some of the students had misconceptions.
A while back, I was doing voter registration here at the college, and some students were saying how they don't vote, they don't ever vote, their vote doesn't count. And I thought, no, this is not okay. No. This is a college. We can do better than that.
The college launched a series of events called Let's Vote. DeSef says the first goal is closing the information gap.
Voting is actually a simple task, but there are lots of components to your ballot that people might not understand. I don't know what that job is. I don't know who those people are. I don't understand the issues. I don't know what to vote for.
Student body president Albert Warnar says the other is localizing races for each student.
So we're local as in we're west of Chicago, but within that there's many places. So things to consider are where to vote. That's a big question, especially around here, because people are in different counties, they don't vote in the same place.
Voter registration is handled by volunteers from within the college and groups such as the League of Women Voters. Patricia Vary with the League says the process goes smoothly for the most part.
A lot of them have come here or staying in a different place than their home, so sometimes their driver's license is their home address, and we have to make sure that we know where they are now and get that on the registration.
After registration comes voter education. Above all, Warnar says it needed to be nonpartisan.
Even down to our form, the issues on our information form are specifically alphabetical, not at all related to issue importance.
Instead of bringing in advocates from parties or interest groups, educators from the college sit down with individual students and guide them to different resources. DeSef says they make use of 3 websites in particular.
Civics 2.0 teaches about government and voting. Vote411.org is a League of Women Voters website. If you give it your address, it will tell you your voting precinct and your voting districts. And votesmart.org is a wonderful website with just a database full of information about all kinds of candidates.
Warnar says these databases also help localize a student's local races.
We have the different websites for the different counties, and the volunteers will run them through the website and say, okay, in your county, these are your candidates, and each candidate usually has a website, and you can go to their website and look at their things. But yeah, it's pretty specific. That's why we have the volunteers sit down individually with people.
Overall, response to this approach has been positive among students. Cassandra Kurzak is from Illinois near St. Louis.
It went really well. It was easy. It was, it made sense. It was very straightforward. I had all the information on me. I didn't have to bring in anything that wasn't already in my wallet or anything. It was wonderful.
Issues remain varied among the student body. For Kurzak, these include human rights and the environment.
Mother Earth could wipe us from the face of the planet if she wanted, and we just need to correct what's going on to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Another student, Cameron Pratt of the Indianapolis area, is concerned about U.S. military action.
Whether we might happen to be launching a war effort that may or may not be necessary or anything like that, and just making the right decision overall on that situation, because, you know, war costs money and we don't have it.
The first Let's Vote campaign had volunteers completely occupied within the first half hour. DeSef, Warnar, and the other organizers hope it can both inform more students and bring them further into the democratic process. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
This is 89.1 FM, WGLT, and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker, and the show is Sound Ideas. Taylor Steele says a spicy sound may soon mix with the Illinois Prairie sound her Effingham-based band is known for. Folk, blues, rock, and country are all part of the gumbo that is currently Taylor Steele and Love Preachers. Ahead of the Bloomington appearance Thursday night, Steele tells WGLT's John Norton a recent trip to New Orleans has her thinking how that city's music could mix with the Love Preachers.
We've already talked about it even before I went. I really love Cajun music, and our drummer Kyle is really into, like, he went to school in New York for like Afro-Cuban percussion and Cajun percussion and all that, so he's really into that. I could see it dipping into our influences.
Well, let's dive right into the debut album. It's called Searching. You put it out last year. I want to play a little bit of the opening track. It's called Jeremiah.
Jeremiah was an angel. He led me with his fingertips. And he
Jeremiah comes from a lot of like Appalachian folk influence. I was probably 13 when I wrote that song.
No kidding. Wow, okay.
And I listened to Gillian Welch a lot at the time. I think that's when I first started listening to her. And I've always loved old folk music anyway. I've always really gravitated towards roots, traditional music.
Who's Jeremiah?
He doesn't exist. He's a spirit. Like when I wrote it, I think of like someone being led down to a river or the ocean. Like, it's about death, really. Mm. It's about dying and like what you might experience in kind of a mystical way.
The song is Jeremiah, the album is Searching, Taylor Steele and the Love Preachers. Well, you're living in Effingham now. I understand you grew up in Collinsville, or at least lived in Collinsville for a while?
Yeah, I grew up in Collinsville. I lived with my mom. My parents have been divorced since I was little, so I ended up moving in with my dad in Greenville, and that's where I went to high school. So I've kind of inched east on 70 my whole life, and I've ended up in Effingham.
What I hear in your music is a lot of what I imagine Southern Illinois to kind of feel like. There's a lot of space in the music. but it's also very melodic, and there's so many different influences going on, from country to blues to Appalachian and folk, and there's so many different influences. When I think of Southern Illinois, that's how I think of it.
I love that. We've been described as capturing the sound of the Midwest one other time before, and it kind of amazed me that first time too. So hearing it again, it allows me to be introspective too and get a different perspective on experiencing my own music, I guess.
Sometimes here in Central Illinois or Northern Illinois, Chicago, there's not an understanding that Southern Illinois has a very strong music scene. And,
I know.
and it has had one historically. Could you talk a little bit about the scene itself?
I started playing in Effingham when I was still in high school. I lived in Greenville, and I would come to Effingham for an open mic every Wednesday. And I ended up meeting Bill Poslakwa, and he has put on Moccasin Creek Festival. He put me on the bill to play. I played my first Moccasin Creek when I was 18. I was able to start, you know, being an artist at a festival. Like, I learned so much being a part of this. In Effingham, I found this, like, community and this music scene and listeners, people that would come and volunteer at the festival and would become, you know, best friends with artists, and we'd all support each other. And even Southern Illinois, like Carbondale, like there's so many talented musicians down there too that I've been lucky enough to get to know and play music with. My bass player, Garrett, he has started Summer Sundown Music Festival, which is in September. And it's like a sister festival to Moccasin Creek. It's a local music festival. It's really supposed to highlight how much talent is in central Southern Illinois.
So let's go to another song on the album, which is called Searching. I want to play Birch. Speaking of gumbo, I hear a combination of like country and Memphis soul in this song.
Yeah, that song didn't really become soulful until I brought it up to the band. I think some of that has to do with, in the 2 years that we've been a band, I've really been able to kind of find my voice more and just, one, become a better singer, but I kind of think of myself as a soul singer now. It out as when I wrote it just on my guitar, you know, by playing it by myself, I thought of it as like this pretty like folk country waltz. And then we brought it with the band, and having keys on it and really kind of arranging it more, it's become this really powerful song.
Well, Lost Girl Blues is another song in the album I'd like to ask you about. This one has that kind of a country blues feel to it. Let's play just a little bit of this. How is it going?
The way that it starts out with just me and the keyboard, and then comes in, and it's kind of like a country shuffle, and it moves along.
Is this about you, or is this about someone else?
This is about me.
This 100%. One is about you, okay.
It's kind of a vulnerable song, really. Lost Girl Blues, I wrote that song around the same time that I wrote Was I Wrong? And at the time, I was living in Greenville still. Lost Girl Blues is a good example of me expressing the thoughts that I haven't been able to say out loud or put into words and express it to myself. It was like me scooping out, being true to myself, being honest with myself, and then putting it out in a song so that I could, like, come to terms, you know? My feelings show, and I love too much, too hard all at once, and I almost kind of think of that song as like a 60s, like maybe folk rock. So sometimes I think of like a woman like dancing around with like flowers in a meadow or something. And like getting in touch with her true, you know, her womanhood, or getting in touch with herself or something, you know. Wish I hadn't been so blind.
Taylor Steele, thank you so much for your time. This is a wonderful release. It's called Searching. Congratulations on that, and continued good luck to you.
Thank you so much, John. Thanks for having me.
Taylor Steele and the Love Preachers open for Neil Francis Thursday night at Jazz Up Front in Bloomington. Discover local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the WGLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. I couldn't say no, and I had to find my way out of the storm. I was a girl, I had a storm over my head. I couldn't seem to ever lay my feet. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, which today came from Ryan Denham. Thanks as well to Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner and to the McLean County Museum of History. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 WGLT-FM and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.